mullet, complete with crooked layers in front and a ratty tail at the back, where I'd left the hair longer to hide my still vivid scar. I would have to seek professional help. Vanity aside, I was trying to keep a low profile, and this look would cause young children to run screaming. On Boulevard Saint-Michel was a salon I liked, but they might remember me, and it was unlikely to be open on a Sunday. Instead, I borrowed the rain jacket and hat again, lowered my sunglasses, and caught the metro to the Chateau Rouge stop in the 18th arrondissement. You could smell and hear the Marché des Gens before you saw it. The unofficial heart of Paris's African community was hopping on a Sunday morning. The stink of meat assaulted you even as you climbed the steps from the metro, wafting over from the Boucherie Amar Frère, a halal butcher. Around the corner, pretty housewives from Senegal haggled over the price of yams. Street traders hawked fake Louis Vuitton bags. Children begging for sticky honeyed pastries spilled out the door of an Algerian bakery. I stopped outside a Tunisian restaurant to get my bearings. Surely there was an Arab hairdresser around here. I was gambling that barbers in this neighborhood might be less likely to abide by the rhythms of a nominally Catholic country, where on a Sunday morning everyone was supposed to be either asleep or in church. Judging by the throngs of people squeezing past me, I had guessed right on that front. I was also gambling that someone used to styling women of color might have experience in rescuing brunettes from bad home dye jobs. A beautiful black woman with platinum blonde hair swept past me on the sidewalk. I caught up with her, paid a compliment, asked directions. She said a name and pointed. It took several wrong turns and another request for directions before I arrived at a brightly tiled establishment fitted with two vinyl barber chairs. The proprietor looked surprised when I walked in, even more surprised when I peeled off my hat and revealed the mess he had to work with. He held up a finger, signaling me to wait, and disappeared into the back. A minute later, he returned with a woman in tow, a baby on her hip and a girl of 4 or 5 trailing behind. The two of them consulted in a language I couldn't understand. Hindi, possibly, or Urdu. They were not African. Then she stepped forward with a surprisingly sympathetic smile. "You did on your own?" she pointed at my scalp. I nodded sheepishly. €100. I fix for you. We'll take some hours." I handed over the money, plus a generous advance tip. When someone is about to attack your head with bleach and a pair of scissors, it's in your interest for the person to feel warmly toward you. I was led to one of the vinyl chairs. The girl shyly offered me tea, then sugar cubes, which she dropped into my cup with tiny silver tongs, and a look of such endearing seriousness that I accepted 3. She disappeared while her mother stood behind me, whipping bleach into a paste in a steel bowl. "Where is your family from?" I asked the woman by way of conversation. "Pakistan? Lahore? And you?" "Lyon." France's third largest city. I knew it reasonably well, should she ask questions. But she merely nodded. The girl reappeared, carrying a stack of comic books. She held one up to me, smiling. I smiled back. She held up another one, pointed at the cover, and giggled. Her mother spoke sharply to her, asking a question in their language. Then the mother began to laugh as well. "She says you look like Tintin." I stared. The Belgian boy adventurer on the cover of her books styled his orange hair in a cowlicky cross between a pompadour and a mohawk. I made to protest, but what was the use? The girl had nailed it. She crawled into my lap and demanded that I read aloud to her the adventures of Tintin and his dog, Snowy, while her mother rubbed a white paste that smelled of lemons into my hair. I emerged into the strong sunlight of early afternoon looking less like Tintin and more like a youngish Mia Farrow. The Pakistani woman had done me right. My hair was dark, golden blonde, shaped into a modern pixie cut, spiky on top, with a flirty flip in the back. The hair just covered my scar. She had deftly avoided touching it, had asked no questions. I walked to a nearby cafe and ordered more tea. The remaining German phone was in my pocket. It was time, I reckoned. I had not checked the news for 3 days. I prepared myself to read about the manhunt that must now be underway for me. The press must be hounding my family in Washington. My heart ached at the scandal and shame I had brought on the Cashin name. On the Journal Constitution mobile site, the murder had ascended to the lead story. Ethan Sinclair was now identified by name. His family was described as shocked and grief-stricken. The Atlanta Bar Association was planning a tribute dinner. There was a more detailed account of the wounds that had killed him, 2 bullet shots to the stomach, fired from close range. Police were still seeking to question a person in connection with the incident. Anyone with relevant information was urged to make an anonymous call to the Crime Stoppers Atlanta tip line, or to text the tip to CRIMES. There was no mention of my name, nothing hinting at a motive for the killing. I did not understand it. I sat until my tea went cold, then removed the chip from the phone and crushed it beneath the heel of my boot. The Marché des Gens had finished for the day, but at the top of the stairs leading back down into the metro, a lone vendor remained. He had a dirty green sheet spread across the sidewalk, loaded with car air fresheners, lighters, knockoff designer sunglasses, and a handful of preloaded cell phones. Combien? I asked, gesturing at the phones. How much? He shrugged. 35? 35. I scoffed and turned to go. But his necklace caught my eye. Rather, not a necklace, but a small leather pouch hanging from a suede strap. Et pour ça?
Ça, non? C'est la dent de mon fille.
That's my son's baby tooth. Not the tooth, silly, just the pouch. He looked dubious. 50. I held out a 50-euro note. For both. He shook a small brown tooth from the pouch into his fingers, unknotted the suede strap and handed it, along with a phone, over to me.
Code for the SIM card is taped to the back, he mumbled.
Once I'd settled into the plastic bucket seat of the train, I unwrapped the bullet from its tissue paper sheath inside my purse, dropped it into the pouch, and tied the strap tight around my neck. The leather was still warm from his skin. That night, I became aware of a man watching me. Back in Hélène's apartment, I had found myself restless. The evening was unseasonably warm. The neighborhood cafes would be packed. My cans of tomato soup were unappealing. I paced the parquet floors, weighing the risks, knowing I should stay inside with the curtains drawn and my nose in a book. But I seemed unable to channel my old risk-averse, introverted self. She bored me. Just after dark, I exited the building by a back service door, slipping into the soft air and walking east, crossing the Seine, hugging back streets and then the banks of the river itself. There is an Italian wine bar near the Odeon that stays open late. On a night like tonight, it would be busy. Knots of people sipping Sangiovese on the sidewalk, waiting for seats at the bar or at one of the red Formica tables. I scanned the wine list and ordered the House Vermentino, a dry white from the hills between Liguria and Tuscany. Then I plunked down on the curb to wait. The crowd was mostly young, mostly locals in expensive denim and leather jackets, lighting each other's cigarettes and chattering in French. I was wearing my sensible boots with black leggings. No makeup, no jewelry, no ornamentation of any kind. My newly blonde cropped hair lay flat against my head. I felt invisible. From inside the restaurant, though, a man kept glancing at me. He was at a table for two in the window, speaking to another man whose back was to me. I could not see his features clearly in the candlelight, just the flash of his dark eyes. They did not look away when I stared back. Suddenly, he was making his way to the bar, speaking to the bartender, pointing outside toward me. My blood froze. I scrambled to my feet, ready to run. But when he appeared at the door, he was holding two glasses.
Je me suis demandé si vous en mirez un autre.
I thought you might like a refill. He nodded in the direction of the bar.
He said you like the Vermentino?
I stepped back, scanned our surroundings for signs of a trap. A squad of armed Interpol agents might be lurking behind him, preparing to storm us from the restaurant kitchen. He took in my tense posture with a raised eyebrow.
You're not going to run away, are you? Je ne mords pas.
I don't bite. I could have been mistaken, but his black eyes were not watching me like those of a cop closing in on his quarry. They were watching me the way a man watches a woman he wants, outside a bar on a velvety night in Paris, when the evening is still young enough that anything could happen. I took the wine.
Comment vous appelez-vous?
What's your name? Simon? It was the first time I'd said it out loud.
Je m'appelle Simon Guérin. Et vous?
And you?
François?
He smiled and produced a pack of cigarettes, shook out one for each of us. I opened my mouth to tell him I don't smoke, then reconsidered. Caroline didn't smoke, never had. Simone, on the other hand, was still making up her mind about such things.
Alors, Simone, parlez-moi de vous.
Tell me about yourself. Je suis écrivaine. I am a writer. That had a crumb of truth. I thought of the book I'd been so excited to write not 3 weeks ago, the one my brother Tony had teased me about in my Georgetown kitchen. The politics of divorce in working-class post-Napoleonic France. It was as though the idea had sprung from the mind of a completely different person. The topic now failed to interest me in the slightest. I began to talk instead about travel memoirs and fat war histories, slim volumes of poetry, and novels with bleak endings that drove you to despair. About all the books I loved to read, and all the ones I wanted to write. And some of what I said was real, and some of it I made up as I went along. His black eyes never left mine. Shall I describe him for you? François was pale with thick dark hair that matched his eyes, tall but delicately boned. He wore a black cashmere turtleneck and skinny jeans, but you already guessed that. He leaned down to kiss me and I let him. Smoke curled up from the cigarettes we held against our hips. He was so precisely my type that his lips felt already familiar. I had kissed a dozen boys just like him, on 100 velvety Paris nights. Paris is a veritable ocean, wrote Balzac. But it is also, he conceded, a moral sewer. Un aigu moral. This can be a good or a bad thing, depending on how remorseful one is prepared to feel the morning after. If they ever called my name for a seat inside, I missed it. At midnight, the candles on the tables had burned low. Every chair was still occupied. The hum of conversation, of easy laughter and whispered seductions, floated out to the sidewalk. The bartender eventually passed us the Vermentino bottle through the window, and we stood there, kissing and talking and smoking until it was finished. When he whispered that his apartment was close by, though, I broke away. I've had my share of lovers, but I've never picked up a stranger in a bar and slept with him. I'm no prude about such things. I simply think a man should have to work a bit harder than that. So much of the pleasure lies in the chase. I kissed him on the cheek this time and said good night.
Attends,
he said. Wait. On a scrap of paper, he wrote his name and a telephone number. I folded it, discovered I had no pockets, tucked it into the leather pouch at my neck. Mist was rising off the Seine as I threaded my way home. I stopped every few hundred yards, listening from darkened doorways, making sure that neither François nor anyone else had followed. 56. Monday, November 11th, 2013. You don't tend to know when you're about to have a momentous day. Morning dawns like any other morning. You stretch, put the kettle on, feed the cat, pat around in blissful ignorance. Only later, when you unfold the fateful letter or the knock sounds at the door, do you realize that the trajectory of your life has irrevocably been altered. In my case, the Messenger was a news website. I bolted upright in bed shortly after 8 a.m., startled from sleep by the blaring horn of a city bus. On the past 2 days, traffic had been light. But today, Paris was roaring to life in full weekday morning rush-hour splendor. Madame Aubuchon lived in an elegant building with leafy views across the Bois de Boulogne. Half a block away, though, thrummed a major artery. You could almost feel the pent-up commuter frustration rising from the streets up to her balcony. I padded to the kitchen and put the kettle on for tea, toasted the last of the baguette and spread it with the dreaded raspberry jam. As I chewed, I scolded myself for being careless last night. I should know better. No more nights out snogging strange men. From this moment forward, my raciest evening encounters would be with a mug of herbal tea and one of Hélène's dog-eared Jack Reacher paperbacks. I had matters to attend to, now that I was rested. I needed to get a fake ID. I needed fresh clothes, the drabber the better. Most pressingly, I should find a new accommodation. Even if Madame Aubuchon did not crack under police pressure, this place was insecure. Staying here was tempting fate. I wanted rooms with no connection to the woman once known as Caroline Cashin. In the shower, I pumped out my usual shampoo dose, to find it was 5 times as much as my new pixie hair required. I made a mental note to add a razor to my shopping list. At this rate, I would soon have more hair on my legs than on my head. After toweling off, I reached for the prepaid phone that I'd bought yesterday from the street vendor. I would check the headlines, crush the chip again, purchase yet another new phone while I ran errands today. I began to read. At the first paragraph, I went pale. By the third, I had crashed down on the side of the bathtub, my eyes twitching, breathing hard. Betsy Sinclair had given an exclusive interview to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. She was pictured looking frail and wearing widow's weeds. Above the article ran a banner headline, "Bereaved Widow Shares Saga of Terror, Tragedy." The story that followed, written by a reporter whose name I did not recognize, bore no resemblance to events as I knew them to have unfolded. Mr. and Mrs. Sinclair had been about to sit down to lunch together in their upscale Buckhead home, the newspaper reported, when their lives were shattered. Earlier that morning, Mr. Sinclair had driven to Henry's Bakery, where he was a regular customer, to buy his wife's favorite sandwich. "We love their pastrami," said Mrs. Sinclair, her voice catching. "Ethan always goes out of his way to bring it home for me, and because he'd been out of town on business, he made a special effort. I came sailing in from my tennis match and found he'd set the table with our wedding china and crystal. 40 years of marriage, and he could still be such a sweetheart." Before the couple could enjoy their romantic meal, however, an armed man burst into the room, according to Mrs. Sinclair. My mind reeled. I plowed on. He came out of nowhere, she said. He was wearing gloves and a ski mask, like you wear an aspen, but you could see his eyes were bloodshot. He was yelling for money, and he was waving a gun around, and Ethan tried to stop him. They were wrestling, and then there was a noise like a clap of thunder. That noise was the sound of two bullets being pumped into Ethan Sinclair's stomach. He is believed to have died almost instantly, said Atlanta Police Lieutenant Jeff Packard. Mrs. Sinclair tried to escape, but the intruder overpowered her, bound her wrists and ankles, and locked her in a laundry room adjacent to the kitchen, she said. She was discovered by the family's longtime housekeeper the following morning. Based on Betsy Sinclair's description, Lieutenant Packard said police are searching for a man last seen wearing a red and black coat and gray pants. I checked and checked again. Nowhere in the article did my name appear. What the holy hell was this? There was no room for misinterpretation, no shades of gray. Betsy Sinclair had lied. Outright lied, both to the newspaper and, by the sound of it, to the detectives investigating her husband's murder. The question was, why? The story must have been a plant. They must have been trying to trick me into thinking I was safe, trying to tempt me from my hiding place. Admittedly, this theory had flaws. The police would blow all credibility if they got caught fabricating a story and shopping it to reporters. The newspaper would blow all credibility if it got caught wittingly printing a fake story. Neither institution would be cavalier about such risks. Still, what other explanation could there be? I threw down the prepaid phone in frustration. It was already blinking low on credit, and I'd only been online 10 minutes. I borrowed a coat from the hall closet, a fur-trimmed cape this time, not the rain jacket, no point in being predictable, and set off for the Renaissance Hotel. I'd passed it on Avenue Poincaré on my way home last night, had noticed the taxi rank and two bellhops in top hats idling outside the entrance. At times in life, nothing feels so comforting as the high-end anonymity of a big American hotel. Usually these times occur when I'm in an unfamiliar city and in desperate need of a ladies' room. Today, I required a different amenity. The business center. It was in the basement. As the computer whirred to life, I stole sideways glances at the room's other occupants. Had the woman at the workstation closest to the door, the one wearing a malevolently striped suit and terrycloth room slippers, had she stared at me longer than necessary? And why had the man beside her jumped up to leave so suddenly? I squeezed my head between my palms, a futile effort to quell the paranoia, and started typing. The CNN.com story included a few details absent from the Journal Constitution account. A neighbor said she had seen a purple minivan screeching away from the Sinclair's house on the morning of the shooting. The man whom police were searching for was described as African-American, with a stocky build, around 5 feet 10 inches to 6 feet tall. Ethan's funeral was to be held at the Episcopal Cathedral of St. Philip this coming Wednesday. The fundamental thrust of the story remained the same, though. Betsy Sinclair swore that she and Ethan had been attacked by a crazed man wearing a ski mask. Like you wear an aspen, she had said. Priceless. I surfed around, checking other news sources. Alexandra James had not touched the story. And why would she? Ethan Sinclair may have been prominent in Atlanta, but he had not enjoyed national stature. Reporters outside Georgia had no reason to take an interest. I read every scrap of information I could find and then leaned back in utter bewilderment. After a while, I cleared my search history, shut down the computer, and walked upstairs to the front desk. Screw disposable phones. I didn't know where in this neighborhood to buy one, and I didn't have time to run around. Was there somewhere I could make a private call? I asked. I was shown to a quaint wooden phone booth in a carpeted hallway running off the lobby. I had had no contact with my family since leaving Atlanta. No way to do so without compromising my security. But I was now frantic to speak with someone who would be on my side to confirm whether it could possibly be true that Betsy Sinclair had not ratted me out. 2 minutes later, Martin accepted the charges.
Sis, you know it's like 6 in the morning here?
Powerful, childlike relief coursed through me at the sound of his voice. Martin, I know, I'm sorry,
It's okay, I was up already. I wasn't expecting to hear from you. You said you were disappearing off the grid for a while.
I frowned. How much farther off the grid could a person get? I had fled to a different continent, cut up my credit cards, shaved off my hair, and changed my name to Simone. I'd converted my cash to loose diamonds, and aside from this call, limited my communications to burner phones. But Martin knew none of this. He didn't even know I was in France.
Sis, you there?
I'm here. Bit of a delay on the line.
So how's Mexico? Enjoying the beach life?
Oh, you know, Mexico's hot, I said evasively. Is, everything okay at home?
Here? Sure. I checked your house over the weekend. Some trash blew into the storm drain, but I swept it out, and everything else looks fine. Haven't actually laid eyes on Mom and Dad in a few days. Work's been crazy. I'm getting slammed by this Abu Dhabi deal. But, let's see. Dad's got some new road race he's training for. Not sure what Mom was up to this weekend. I guess church, flower guild, the usual.
This all sounded spectacularly normal. The police had not showed up. My family did not yet know what I had done. Incredible.
This must be weird for you, being out of touch. I know you usually talk to Mom like 17 times a day.
Slight exaggeration.
Not much of one. I was thinking about it. How if I were you, if I'd lived through what you have, I wouldn't let Mom and Dad out of my sight either. I mean, I know you don't remember anything, but maybe deep down you do remember your first parents and the way that you lost them. And it's made you stick close to Mom and Dad all these years.
I winced. I don't know. Maybe. I've tried and tried to remember, but it's all blank. We were both quiet for a moment.
On a different note, have you talked to Tony? Asked Martin. You should call him.
Okay. Why? Anything wrong?
No. Only that your married doctor called him.
I did a double take. Will?
Yep. Tony threatened to, how to put this tactfully, he threatened to cut off Will's dick and feed it to the snakehead fish in the Potomac if he ever came near you again.
Tony would have meant it, too. But why did Will call Tony?
You should ask him. Tony, I mean. I'm just repeating secondhand. But I gather Will's desperate to talk to you when you haven't been answering your phone, so he was trying to get Tony to pass along a message.
I thought about this. I certainly hadn't been answering my phone. It was buried in sludge at the bottom of the Chattahoochee River.
Will moved out. Out of that house we drove to, the one on Lorcom Lane. That's what he told Tony, anyway.
Jesus. Fuck.
Whoa, you really have unplugged. Don't think I've ever heard you swear before.
Martin sounded amused.
My offer to kneecap him stands for what it's worth. Anyway, I gotta run. Drink a margarita for me. And listen, sis, will you be home for your birthday? Or Thanksgiving? Mom will want to know.
I don't know. It was the truth. My birthday was in 15 days. Thanksgiving fell 2 days after that. If the next couple of weeks proved remotely as interesting as the last one had been, I had absolutely no idea where I might be. Only one person knew for sure why Betsy was lying. Contacting her seemed a staggeringly stupid thing to do, but I couldn't see that I had an alternative. I waited until mid-afternoon, when it would be 9 a.m. in Atlanta. I used the time to purchase yet another prepaid phone, this one from a reputable phone store and loaded with €100 in credit. On the off chance that she actually took my call, I didn't want to risk being cut off. A hushed female voice answered the phone at the Sinclair residence. Mrs. Sinclair was resting and not accepting calls, the woman informed me, but the family appreciated my thoughtfulness at this difficult time. I think she might want to speak with me, I insisted. Could I trouble you to check? Please tell her it's Caroline calling. The voice hesitated. I'm not sure. What may I say it's regarding? I'll hold, I said, ignoring the question. If you could tell her that Caroline Smith is on the line. That ought to get her out of bed. A long pause followed, punctuated by several clicks, as if an extension in another room was being picked up and the first one disconnected. I heard breathing. Mrs. Sinclair, are you there? More breathing. Then a hoarse laugh. Do you know where I'm standing right now? In my laundry room. My goddamn laundry room. It's the only place in the house where I can shut the door and escape all these people who've come to be helpful. And the funny thing is, you're the only person in the world who would grasp the irony in that. In my hiding in here with the dryer lint to take a call from you. I'm sorry. I never meant for you to— Shut up, you little tramp, she spat. I'll do the talking. We'll speak this once and then never again. Do you understand? I was too stunned to respond. You'll have seen the newspaper stories by now, I imagine. You'll have read my account of how my husband died. Her voice sounded flayed, raw from weeping. You will have noticed there was no mention of you. There will never be any mention of you, not in connection with my husband. Do you understand? No, I did not. Why did you lie? She drew a shuddering breath. Your whore mother tried to destroy my family 30 years ago. Your husband did destroy my family 30 years ago, I retorted. You're not the only victim here. That was all behind us, decades behind us. There was no reason for you to come here, no reason to rip open old scars, and there is nothing. Do you hear me? Nothing that would give me greater pleasure than sending you to prison for the rest of your life. So why did you— Shut up, she hissed. I said what I said because I had quite a long time to think, tied up and gagged in here on the laundry room floor. You made sure of that. If I identify you, if I tell that it was you who killed Ethan, everyone will wonder why. Don't you see? Why would some hoity-toity professor with no prior record gun down my husband? The police would want to know the motive. She was crying now. Everything would come out. All of Ethan's affairs, everything about him and Sadie Rawson. and that something terrible happened that day, and that two people died, and somehow that baby girl got shot.
You mean me?
I mean you,
she whispered.
Then she said, if I tell the police the truth, it would ruin you. But it would ruin me, too. I would be a pariah, known all over Atlanta as the wife of a philandering murderer. The wife of the man who shot a baby girl and left her for dead. You were so little, she moaned. Still in your pink pigtails, hiding behind your mother's skirts. Can you imagine the shame if all that came out? It's not the kind of thing that people would forget.
So you made up a story about a crazy man with a gun.
It was the only way out that I could think of. People will believe me. They already do.
She was clever. And correct.
People would believe sweet Betsy Sinclair. I felt impressed and a little sick. I will not allow my family to be ripped apart. Not now. I will not allow Ethan's name to be dragged through the mud. I swear to God, you'll have to come back with your gun and shoot me first.
That won't be necessary, I said softly.
After some minutes, she sniffled, coughed, and cleared her throat.
Does anyone else know? Have you told anyone?
I was about to ask you the same thing. The hoarse laugh again, even sadder now.
I've lived with my husband's secrets for a long, long time. I can live with this new one, too.
Please don't call me again, Caroline.
I am asking you, I am begging you to keep your mouth shut.
Leave my family alone. The phone line went dead. I wiped tears from my eyes and thought about all the ways we hurt the people we love, and how long those wounds can fester.
How had Faulkner put it?
The past is never dead. It's not even past.
57. The police were not looking for me. They never had been. I had embraced the fugitive mindset so firmly that this would take time to sink in. I found myself doubting, still casting glances over my shoulder. 79 euros and 18 cents of credit remained on my phone. I tapped it to make one final call to Atlanta.
Caroline, I'm glad you decided to call me back, said Beamer Beasley. You still in France?
I was sitting on a low stone wall overlooking the Seine. Bateaux mouches glided past on the river below, their giant open decks dotted with tourists. The Eiffel Tower loomed on the left bank. It was late afternoon, and the sun was a low orange ball, warm on my face and arms. Now I felt myself go cold. It was his use of the word still.
Anyone with caller ID could see the +33 country code and divine that I was speaking from a French phone, but still implied that this wasn't news. Still implied that Beasley had already known I was here.
Yes, still in France.
No point denying it.
How did you know that?
I took the liberty of making a few calls. Once I verified, you never got on that plane to Mexico.
And why were my whereabouts of interest?
Well, originally to inform you about the death of Ethan Sinclair. I assume you've read the news reports by now, though.
Yes. My leg had begun to tremble. What a terrible shock.
It certainly is. His poor widow is taking it awful poorly. You've never met her, have you? Betsy Sinclair.
I said nothing. Waited to see where he was going with this.
"The thing is," he said, "the thing is, there are a couple of curious details that haven't made their way into the newspaper. A couple of loose ends, I guess you'd call them."
"Oh?" My leg jounced up and down uncontrollably. I pressed my palm down against my knee, trying to hold still against the stone wall, trying to fight down the panic.
"Mind you, I'm not working a Sinclair investigation myself, so this is only what I happen to overhear in the hallway. Water cooler chit-chat."
"Beamer, out with it," I heard myself rasp.
"Well, Mr. Sinclair was old-fashioned about technology and whatnot. He did own a cell phone, which we can't find. But he didn't keep his calendar electronically. He recorded his appointments in a little purple leather book. We found it in his back pocket."
"Ah."
"And the day he got killed? The day Mrs. Sinclair says he surprised her with a romantic pastrami and rye on the good china, he had an entry for lunch with C. The time slot overlaps exactly with the coroner's window for his time of death. Isn't that interesting?"
"Not particularly," I hedged. "Maybe he canceled lunch with someone in order to eat with his wife."
"Betsy Sinclair says C meant her. Says he always called her Carissima, dearest one, ever since their honeymoon in Rome. Sweet, isn't it?"
I waited, wary.
"I just mention it in passing. Now, the other curious thing, two hairs. Two long, dark brown hairs. Caucasian. They were removed from Mr. Sinclair's sweater sleeve. Tech can't find a match for them."
I closed my eyes. The image of Ethan Sinclair squeezing his hand around my neck swam into focus. My hair sheeting across my face, covering his arms. Two strands of hair, my DNA at the crime scene, on the victim's body. How could I possibly explain that?
"Betsy Sinclair is a blonde, as you may be aware. The alleged perpetrator is described as African-American, so the hairs aren't his. We've ruled out the housekeeper."
"Ethan's granddaughters?" I asked weakly. "His secretary?"
"Checking all of them. But you know what, Caroline? You know what my theory is? My theory is, once a ladies' man, always a ladies' man."
"What are you talking about?"
Beasley sighed. "When I overheard the guys discussing the hairs and how they couldn't find a DNA match in the system, I might have mentioned that Mr. Sinclair had a reputation for occasionally wandering outside the marital bed. I might, Lord forgive me, have suggested that it would be a kindness to the victim's widow not to make too big a stink about another woman's hairs being stuck to his sleeve. I might have even gone so far as to strongly advise my colleague in charge of the investigation that we show some compassion and not add to the poor family's grief."
"But your colleague's job isn't to show compassion. It's to find out who killed Ethan Sinclair."
"Mm-hmm. But we have an unassailable witness, a church-going, God-fearing grandma, who's prepared to swear on the Holy Bible that her husband was shot by a big black guy who broke into their house. That's who we're looking for. My colleagues aren't going to devote a lot of energy to chasing Caucasian brunettes."
I took this in.
"Doesn't mean they won't find the DNA eventually. All these new advances every year. Like that maintenance man case I told you about. Those hairs from Mr. Sinclair's sleeve. Whoever they belong to would want to be awful careful not to find a reason to get their DNA tested. Not ever to end up in the national database.
Thank you, I whispered.
For what?
Just thank you.
You know, it's taken me a long while to grasp this. But sometimes justice is served in ways that have precious little to do with the criminal justice system.
That night, sitting cross-legged on Madame Aubuchon's bed, I laid two objects on the white sheets. The first was the disposable phone, reduced now to a mere 43 euros in credit. I had used it to remotely access my old voicemail and had discovered no fewer than 9 messages from Will Zartman. The first 8 were short, only a few seconds each in duration, presumably of the "call me, would you please call me" variety. I deleted them. But the last one ran nearly 3 minutes long. I couldn't bring myself either to erase it or to listen. Next to the phone, I unfolded the second object. A piece of paper from inside the leather pouch knotted around my neck. I smoothed it flat against the sheets. Angular handwriting, black ink, the name Francois, and a phone number. My hand hovered, hesitated. I reached for the phone and dialed. "Hey," I said when he answered, then leaned back against the pillows.
"Hello?" came the cautious response. "Caroline? Is that you?"
"It's me."
Will heaved a deep breath. "Thank God. Are you okay? Where are you?"
"In Paris. Long story."
"But you're okay. How's your neck? Your wrist?"
"Fine. Better every day."
"Thank God," he breathed again. "Marshall Gellert said you missed your last 2 appointments, that you didn't refill your painkiller prescription. I didn't know if you..."
"My brother said you moved out." I didn't have the patience to beat around the bush.
"Oh," answered Will in a quiet voice. "Yes, we're separated, my wife and me. Caroline, I made a terrible mistake not telling you. I know that. There was never a..."
"Never a good time? Is that what you were about to say? See, because I would argue that before you kissed me, that night in Atlanta would have been a good time."
"I know, I know. I thought you'd run screaming for the hills."
"Well, that's true. I can't say I was exactly yearning to get involved with a married man with 2 kids and a soft spot for Garth Brooks."
"You make me sound like quite the catch."
"Make that a married, middle-aged baseball fanatic with kids and a house in the suburbs and..."
"Yet you called."
He cut me off gently.
"Why?"
"Why indeed? Why risk my heart on a man with baggage? A man who had lied to me, a man who might, who knew, be lying even now about being separated." "I miss you," I said. But it was more than that. I had allowed Will to touch me at a level deeper than I had allowed any of my previous predictable lovers, perhaps deeper than I had been capable of just weeks ago. If he came with baggage, then so be it. I was carrying quite a lot of baggage of my own by now.
"I miss you too. Come home."
Not until sometime after midnight did I stir beneath the white sheets, open my eyes, and realize that Betsy Sinclair was still lying. I had been dreaming of a girl with dark hair tied back in pink ribbons. "Still in your pink pigtails," Betsy had said, "hiding behind your mother's skirts." Pink pigtails. That detail had not appeared in the press accounts at the time of the murders. To my knowledge, no photograph of me from that day had been released. Possibly Ethan had described my appearance to his wife, but it seemed an odd detail to have mentioned. So how could she have known? How could she have known the color of my ribbons unless she had been there and seen me? I sat up in bed and ran my fingers through my now short, now blonde hair. Watched a shadow crawl across the bedroom wall, cast by the headlights of a passing car. What was Betsy up to? The phone in Atlanta rang and rang. I was about to hang up and redial a third time when she picked up. She sounded exhausted. "I told you never to contact me again," she rasped. "I'm going to hang up, and if you have the slightest scrap of sense, you'll do the same." "How did you know I was hiding behind my mother's skirt when she died, Betsy? Or that my hair was tied in pink pigtails?" Several seconds of silence. Then, "I have no idea what your hair looked like. I don't even remember saying that. What kind of crazy questions are these? Caroline, if you keep harassing me, God is my witness, I will tell the police the truth. I'll tell them who shot Ethan. Do you hear me? I will call them right now." "I think you were there, in the house on Eulalia Road that day. I think you saw me." "You are out of your mind." "No, I'm not. You were there. You saw it. Tell me what happened." She was breathing fast, little pants of air whistling down the phone line. "They're all dead, Betsy. Everyone who was in that room except you and me. Who are you protecting anymore?" She held out another few seconds. When she spoke, it was in a snarl. "Your mother knew how to provoke a person. You have no idea. Sadie Rawson would stand there all snooty and superior in her too short skirt and her too high heels, wiggling her bottom, just throwing it in your face like the floozy she was. I only went over there to make her give me the necklace, to make her stop parading it around all over Buckhead."
"What necklace?"
"The one Ethan gave her. A sapphire floating on a gold chain. Maya and Berkeley mailed the bill to our house. I had to write them a check for it, to keep our account in good standing. Do you have any idea what that feels like?"
Her voice rose to a shriek. "So you and Ethan went over to the Smiths' house together? To ask for the necklace back?" But this version of events didn't make sense either. A knot of dread was hardening between my shoulder blades.
"I drove over there myself, to make her give it back and to tell her never to show her face again, not anywhere within 100 feet of my family. She told me to go to hell. She taunted me, said my husband had never loved me and the necklace was hers to keep."
From deep within me, something caught. A sapphire. A sparkle of blue. I could see it. I remembered. Deep blue against a white throat. A cloud of black hair. Warm arms holding me close. Female voices raised in fury.
"I didn't go over there to kill her. I'm not a monster. I only wanted to scare her. I had Ethan's gun, the one he kept in his nightstand, and I took it out to show her I meant it, to make her listen. And then your daddy walked in the middle of the afternoon. I forgot he worked those crazy pilot hours. Boone started carrying on and shouting at me to keep quiet, and I told him his wife was filth, and he came at me, and he was going to grab the gun, and I just...
You shot him?
It happened so fast. So fast. He fell over and I was going to help him, but your mama flew at me. She hit me. She said I would go to jail forever, that my babies would be orphans, that she would make sure of it. I couldn't.
I couldn't let her do that.
I closed my eyes, saw the gleam of blue again. There had been noises, great cracking explosions of sound, and then a pinch in my neck and my mother sinking soft against me onto a red tiled floor. Did I in fact remember this? Was I inventing the memory now? Did it matter?
I didn't know you were hurt.
I wasn't thinking about you at all. I was in shock and I called Ethan. He was there in minutes. He dug the bullet out of the door, but he couldn't find the other one. And it was only then that we... Betsy drew a great shuddering breath. We thought you were dead, too.
You weren't breathing, or it didn't look like you were. I wouldn't have left you. I wouldn't have left a child.
Why did he help you? I whispered. You had just killed the woman he loved.
One of many women he thought he loved over the years, she said bitterly. I was his wife, the mother of his children. He wasn't going to let me go to prison, was he?
My tongue lay thick and heavy in my mouth. I had to concentrate to lift it, to force it to form words. So he didn't do it. Ethan didn't shoot my parents. You did. He was protecting you all these years.
Yes, she said simply.
Sadie Rawson's necklace. The sapphire. You took it.
It won't ever be found, if that's what you're asking.
My mind flashed through the events of recent weeks, struggling to recalibrate. What about... Who broke into my house in Georgetown the other night, then? Who took the files from my surgeon's office?
I'm sure I don't have the faintest idea what you're talking about. But one can imagine that a professional might find ways to accomplish all sorts of things for the right price.
A strange, almost comfortable silence settled between us. Two women who had done their worst to each other, sitting alone in our darkened bedrooms thousands of miles apart. At last, sweet Betsy Sinclair cleared her throat.
I'm going to say goodbye now, Caroline. But let me leave you with this thought. You shot an innocent man and you're going to get away with it. Don't be stupid. Keep your mouth shut. Walk away.
58. Tuesday, November 12th, 2013. There is a café on the Rue de Grenelle where you can sit and order a crème café and watch the patrons come and go. It's a humble establishment, not one of the famous Paris cafés. Sartre never held court here. Neither did Hemingway nor Picasso. They preferred Les Deux Magots, a few blocks farther east. I've always favored the Rue de Grenelle café for precisely this reason. It caters to the neighborhood, not to celebrities or tourists. Old men greet each other. A woman tears pieces of her morning croissant and feeds them to her dog. An elegant couple in their 20s, still dressed in shimmering evening clothes from the night before, sit smoking at a table on the sidewalk. He kisses her and she lifts her face to him, and you see that she is tired yet achingly beautiful. I sip my coffee and watch them. I despise coffee. Never touch the stuff. A surprise to find myself craving it this morning. A surprise to find it tastes delicious, rich and nutty. You think you know yourself. You think you know whether you care for coffee, whether you care for cigarettes, whether you like to swear, whether you could kill a man. You think you know what you are capable of, Then one day you discover that, quite literally, you are not the person you thought you were. Onto the cafe table before me, I shake the bullet from its leather pouch. It rolls unevenly, coming to rest against the raised chrome rim. Ethan Sinclair had not pulled the trigger, had perhaps never pulled a trigger in his life. I had imagined myself administering justice, a pure biblical justice, an eye for an eye. In fact, I have murdered a man who, if not exactly innocent, was not guilty either. The true killer is alive and well. She is, at this moment, ensconced in her Buckhead mansion, poised to live to a ripe old age, surrounded by loving children and grandchildren. Anger bristles through me. Justice is not served. Old wrongs are not righted after all. My own action adds yet another notch to the groaning tally of wrongs, but does it cancel out the original act? My instinct is no. The scales are not yet balanced. Laid before me, then, a choice. Follow Betsy's advice and walk away, or go back and finish what's been left undone. It's mine to decide when this story will end. For now, I rise, push back my chair, and walk north to the river. Halfway across the Pont Royal, with the Louvre straight ahead and the Musée d'Orsay at my back, I stop. Pigeons flap lightly above my head, circling a bread crust abandoned on the paving stones. The walls of the bridge are low here, barely waist high. I lean forward over the jade water, hold out my fist. It takes only an instant for a bullet to split the air and steal a life. Only an instant to wreck such sorrow. The heart breaks and it cannot be mended, not to the shape that it once was. Today, though, the bullet will drop like a harmless pebble, like an acorn dropping from an oak. The water will swallow it with barely a ripple, or perhaps with no sound at all. I stand beneath the vast pale sky and I open my hand and let it fall. This concludes the reading of The Bullet by Mary Louise Kelly. Copyright 2015 by Mary Louise Kelly. This book was read by Cassandra Campbell. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Levine Greenberg Rosten Literary Agency and was produced in 2015 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.